Alrighty, lots to do today. We're going to talk about our time, or at least my time, in a lecture called Jesus in the Marketplace. We're going to start with an overview of American religion. Folks, this is quick and dirty. In the last 30 years, there has been an unprecedented emphasis on the self, on individuals in our culture. That is true of American religion. The emphasis is on individual religious experience. There's a new emphasis not on being religious, but being spiritual. Spiritual, whatever the hell that means. We have also seen in your time the deterioration of the historic denominational structure of American religion, and the rise of independent, non-denominational Bible churches, many of them huge urban megachurches, can you say Second Baptist, dominated by a single charismatic, always male leader. That's new. Also, and finally, as a result of the changes in the immigration laws in the 60s, as we've already said, there has been a great growth of world religions in the United States in the last 30 years, especially Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. In the political realm, something new has happened. We have seen the rise of politically active conservative Christianity. This politically active conservative Christianity is unusual because it has seen a very weird combination, union of evangelical Protestants and conservative Roman Catholics. And especially amongst conservative evangelical Protestants, in the last 30 years, an emphasis and focus on Jesus in religious experience and practice has emerged in a totally unprecedented way. We speak now with all kinds of resonance in our culture about the born-again experience. 50 years ago, you might not have that, you couldn't quite tell what people were talking about. Everyone knows what that means again now. You have had an intense personal relationship with Jesus, and now you are a true Christian. Over and over in my religious surveys, I have kids say, I was raised a Methodist, but 2 years ago I became a Christian. Weird formulation. This born-again Christianity is now enthroned in the White House. Our president's favorite philosopher is Jesus. And young people, for the first time in American history, Jesus divides our culture in an absolutely important way. It divides it culturally and politically. In some sense, Jesus and conservative Christian practice is the most salient point of division in American politics right now. Is Jesus your personal savior? If so, you're on one side. If not, you're on the other. I know that's a generalization, but for the first time, I can make that generalization in American history. This is happening at a time when the rest of the world, the Western European world, has entered into what clearly is a post-Christian era. Europeans simply do not know what to make of our cowboy Christian president and his Jesus talk. They think overwhelmingly that the nation has simply taken leave of its senses and is ruled by religious fanatics that are not to be distinguished from Islamic fundamentalists. Folks, you are sitting in and enduring with Dr. Miller a course that is simply unthinkable in Western Europe. You cannot imagine a course in the Sorbonne called Jésus, whatever, Jésus en français? No, it's not going to happen. Jesus in France? No. Jesus in Russia? Probably not. Bulgaria? Jesus in America. Those two books that I showed you at the beginning of the semester that started this course, American Jesus, Jesus in America, unthinkable in Germany. This is an American phenomenon. Why? Part of it has to do with the rise of self-absorption. That would be you. A totally self-absorbed. We want to be connected to someone personally. And the incarnate God, Jesus, has turned out to be perfect for that intense personal relationship that so resonates with our culture. Individualism is just made for Jesus. And more importantly, probably, is the rise of the marketplace in our culture. The marketplace now rules America in a way that is without precedent in the history of the Republic. Our basic identity, whether we want to believe it or not, is as consumers. When the plane struck and we asked our president what we were to do to help, what did he say? Go to the mall. Corporations rule our culture. If you don't believe that, you haven't been paying attention. And in the corporate market culture, Jesus is everywhere. And he is everywhere in the popular culture that the marketplace has produced. And I'm going to bring some of that to show you on Friday. And you already know about this anyhow. And this is what we're going to be talking about this week. Jesus in the marketplace. So hang in there. In order to do that, I need to say just a few words about the 70s. Did any of you have to live through the 70s? Bless your heart. They weren't worth living through. The 70s and the Jesus people that we associate with them grew up out of the hippie movement, the flower culture of the late 1960s. And here I think is a beautiful hippie Jesus, kind of a blissed out Jesus. It had its center in San Francisco and in Southern California in the late 60s and early 70s. Young, white, middle and upper class kids in rebellion against the values of American culture, often experimenting with drugs, and Jesus turned out to be the latest high. Get high on Jesus. They call themselves Jesus freaks. They lived between their square parents of the 1940s and 50s and the much more radical rebels produced by the counterculture of the late 60s and early 70s. They weren't quite hip enough. But like that latter counterculture, the emphasis in amongst the Jesus people was on individuality and on self-actualization. It also had a strong communal element. In fact, it led to a kind of a proliferation of cults, particularly ones like the ones that was led by David Berg, called the Children of God. And the People's Temple, led by Jim Jones, that ended tragically in South America in mass suicides. Secular radicals like Jack Kerouac may have looked for the divine in great Eastern religions on the road, right? In the Dharmas. But these middle-class, young, hip versions looked for Jesus in a hipper version of Protestant Christianity that focused not on churches, but on spirituality. The modern charismatic movement, young people, was born amongst these Jesus people. They experimented in tongues speaking, healing, and they were often terribly, intensely evangelical. And these are the people who are the background for the first musical treatments of parts of Jesus' life that are so wonderful in the 1970s. Now, you don't know much about the great musicals. Musicals now are these big Disney kinds of things with overmacking and all that kind of stuff. You don't know about the great heyday. For instance, has anyone ever seen a production of something like South Pacific or Oklahoma or those great, great musicals of the 1940s and 50s? Young people, they are America's gift to the world. They are wonderful, wonderful things. And they often, at like Oklahoma and South Pacific, they often talked about very radically and controversial issues like racial prejudice, hatred, or what have you. In the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the ferment in American culture grew so intense that almost naturally it percolated up, I think it's almost something inevitable about this, percolated up into a musical expression of part of the life of Jesus. Now, none of these is the total life of Jesus, the greatest story, the slowest story ever told, and King of Kings killed all of that out. They're parts of the life of Jesus. And the first one is a wonderful thing called Godspell. Has anyone ever done part of Godspell? Has anyone ever performed in Godspell? No. 1973. Godspell was first an off-Broadway show, a very modest off-Broadway show. And Jesus in Godspell is a clown. That's all there is, a clown. Folks, how many of you are afraid of clowns? Look around. Smart people, clowns. Oh, it's a very serious, it's a very widespread. It's not a phobia. People just hate clowns. Get away from me, you freak. Jesus is a clown. Jesus is a fool. Jesus as Harlequin, the jester. This is not a new idea, as many of you know, because you've read your assignment, haven't you? 1959, Harvey Cox wrote The Feast of Fools. It has the last chapter, Christ the Harlequin, based on 1 Corinthians 1. Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And Cox says in this article, even in the biblical portrait of Christ, there are elements that can easily suggest clown symbols, like a jester. Christ defies custom and scorns crowned heads. Like a wandering troubadour, he has no place to lay his head. Like the clown in the circus parade, he satirizes existing authority by riding into town replete with regal pageantry when he has no earthly power. Like a minstrel, he frequents dinners and parties. At the end, he is costumed by his enemies in a mocking caricature of royal paraphernalia. He is crucified amongst sniggers and taunts with a sign over his head that lampoons his laughable claims. Godspell is, how many of you have seen this movie? All right. Godspell is set in an entirely empty New York City. Kiddos, I don't have any idea how they emptied out New York City for this movie. It's really a very strange thing. And it features two buildings that are no longer there. The World Trade Center that had just been built is prominently on display in Godspell. In fact, this entirely empty urban landscape becomes one of the central characters of the movie. It begins with John the Baptist, who is dressed, who is sort of like a circus barker. John the Baptist is calling the people to prepare the way of the Lord. And he gathers a group around that becomes his disciples, John the Baptist's disciples. But this weird guy in his shorts shows up with funny hair and says, hey, I want to be what get washed up. This is Jesus. And he becomes the sinner. There is much free-spirited play as they dress as clowns, actually, and have Jesus paint their faces. It's a sign of their calling. And there's much free-spirited 1970s having a good time. But this free-spirited movie quickly becomes perhaps the darkest of the cinematic lives of Jesus. Their antics are then contrasted to what happens as they grow, as they increasingly realize Christ's mission and his fate, and then he is betrayed. Jesus preaches one of the most apocalyptic sermons in the entire tradition as he destroys the devil, that big silly robot. And John the Baptist becomes whom? He becomes Judas and betrays him. We're not told why at all. At the Lord's Supper, Jesus removes their makeup. The party is over. He is then betrayed. How is Jesus crucified? How does he die in this movie? You know? He's electrocuted on a wire fence, on a wire fence you will see. But it ends with one of the strangest resurrection scenes in the entire cinematic life of Jesus tradition. They're carrying his body around a corner of a completely empty street. Then what happens? The end. You gonna tell me? All of a sudden, all the people emerge, and tons of people. New York City has come alive. Jesus lives in the press of humanity. People were not offended by this. Folks, this is just good, clean fun. But what can you say about Jesus after you've represented him as a clown? Some barrier is broken here, right? Right. But this was all good, clean fun. And also, this clown becomes ferocious. Folks, that close-up of Jesus saying, "You vipers," with that his makeup running, that's a scary scene. And that is probably the most apocalyptic moment in the entire tradition. And then what happens to evil? Whap! Boy, do we get serious real quick. Alrighty? Now, Jesus Christ Superstar, different story. Because it's not about clowns. It's about real people in real situations in the Holy Land, and it's about sex. Here we go. You remember in the run-up to my stories about the greatest story ever told. He had all these celebrities, these movie stars, playing these roles, and people said to him, "That will be distracting." He will say, "Hey, that's John Wayne," right? And he said, what? 40 years from now, no one will know. Because guess what? George Stevens knew something about American celebrity. But here is a movie about it doesn't last. Here is a movie about Jesus as celebrity. Jesus Christ Superstar, 1973. This actually is a rock import from Britain. Can anyone tell me what Jesus Christ Superstar starts as? What's the first incarnation of Superstar? Yes, it's an album, vinyl. It's a track, it's a score without a play. It was an instant bestseller. My Lord, people loved this. And then Weber and Rice made a London stage show, tremendous success, brought it to Broadway, ruled Broadway for years. 1973, it was made into a movie starring Ted Neely. Do you know this poor schmo is still singing Jesus today with that horrible high? I don't have any idea how that screeching has not destroyed his voice. It probably has. I don't want to hear it. Jesus Christ Superstar anticipates our own culture of celebrity. In 1966, John Lennon had said that the Beatles were, quote, more popular than Jesus. Well, that got them in all kinds of trouble. They burned Beatles records and all that kind of stuff. But this began, actually, the interest in Jesus as a celebrity at the beginning of a culture that is of a time that in which it's been become sort of defined as celebrity. We are the culture of violence, consumers, and celebrity. That's it, the big three. This is a fascinating Jesus. The Jesus of Superstar is a beaten man. He's been beaten by the system. He's been beaten by the Jewish religious system. He's been beaten by the Roman political system. And most important of all, he has been beaten down by his own celebrity. Jesus is a celebrity here trying to escape from it. And at the Last Supper, he accuses his disciples of devouring him. "For all you care, this could be my body," is what he says to them. "You're eating me. You are devouring me. You're destroying me." He is the celebrity striking back at those who reach out to him and need him. This Jesus is no revolutionary. He teaches no doctrine of revolution or reform. He preaches and teaches hardly at all. If there is any gospel according to this Jesus, it is, find your own salvation in the world and in another world. It's up to you. But he finally realizes that there is a God, that it is his Father, and that he has a job to do. But he doesn't seem in the Garden of Gethsemane to know what good it will do. Folks, this is the least attractive Jesus in the tradition. This Jesus is irritable, angry, resentful, terrified, and he has a horrible, screeching, falsetto tenor voice. There is no divinity here. I'm sorry, there is divinity here, but it's not in Jesus. It's in the Father. This Jesus is all too human and tragic. And most important, the interaction with this Jesus and his followers is intensely personal. And we see here Jesus interacting with other human beings. We get inside of his interior landscape. We know what he's thinking because he tells you. In fact, he screams it at you. This is intensely personal. People can identify with. Now, Jesus Christ Superstar is also fascinated by Jesus' relationship with Judas and Mary Magdalene. And here is the beginning of a tradition that continues to our time. Lives of Jesus that are as much concerned about the betrayer and the Magdalene as they are about Jesus. Judas here is the virtual co-star of the movie. The role, by contract, must be played by what kind of a man? A black man. If you have seen Superstar produced in churches without a black man, they're in violation of the contract. And this black man truly loves Jesus. And he alone seems to understand what the celebrity is doing to Jesus. Judas has figured it out. He has, in fact, become the beloved disciple before he succumbs to this temptation and betrays Jesus. And in the film version, or actually in every version, it is Judas who is gloriously resurrected near the end of the film. Jesus in this film is not very interesting at all. Judas is. And so is Mary Magdalene, who gets to work out all the implications of this sexuality-charged relationship with Jesus. And let's face it, she gets to sing one of the all-time great show tunes, love songs. All righty?